I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in Unalaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Coming up on Hometown Alaska, hosts Dave Waldron and Kim Sherry sit down to discuss some of their favorite show moments from the past year. We'll hear about winter beekeeping, cosplay, the sounds of nature, and more. And on State of Art, join me, Ammon Swenson, for a conversation about Overland. The locally developed play, formerly titled Blanche Stewart Scott, will be traveling to New York for performances at the end of January. We'll also talk about the fundraising show in Anchorage ahead of their trip to the Big Apple. That's all coming up next on Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron.
And I'm Kim Sherry.
And today, we're both looking back on some of the show's best moments from 2025. From winter beekeeping to making music with solar radiation, we've covered some really interesting Alaskans and what it is they do to make the state such a unique and fantastic place to live. Kim, you've been hosting the show with me now, not together, but separately for a little over a year. How's it been going for you? And when I first met you as a contestant on The Great American Recipe, you were talking about wanting to become an ambassador for our state. And I was like so happy when I found out that you're going to host the show, because it seems like a great way to be an ambassador of Alaska.
It has been fascinating. You know, I'm kind of selfish and I pick stories about things that I really want to learn about or I'm curious about. And oh my gosh, the range of different kinds of stories I've done. I mean, I think I've actually gotten smarter. Can you believe that?
That's always the goal. I always learn something here in this studio, and I'm always fascinated by the people that I meet. And, you know, we do have a lot of say in the topics that we pick, but, you know, we have a great producer, Ammon Swenson. He is a great foundation for us and helps us focus on those topics and make them something that anyone could be interested in. And I just want to say, you know, at the top of the show here, if anyone has ideas or something that they really want to hear on Hometown Alaska, please don't hesitate to email us, hometown@alaskapublic.org. We're always open to your ideas so that it's not just the Kim, Dave, Ammon show. You know, and we do have some great people in the building that also give us some ideas as well. So Kim, let's dive into some of our favorite audio segments from the past year. We're going to start out, oddly enough, with owl pellets and scat. I've caught a lot of your shows. I loved your chocolate one that I heard recently, the Wild Scoops one too. Your zoo one you did was my all-time favorite of yours. I thought that was such a great show. But I did not catch this one. So what was the larger topic that you were discussing?
So the larger topic here was concealed creatures in our hometown of Anchorage. When you go out on the trails, or even sometimes in your very own backyard, you know, there's a lot going on that a lot of times we have no idea what's happening out there. And so this conversation is about how to kind of look around and be more observant and ways that you can kind of tell what's out there by maybe the things on the ground or, you know, things that maybe you hadn't noticed before.
So let's go ahead and take a listen to this clip. This is from the Concealed Creature Show.
What are some of the hidden signs left behind by night creatures? You know, what are we looking for? Tracks, droppings? How do we know they've been there?
Pellets for owls, definitely.
And what does a pellet look like? Describe it in detail.
Well, so a pellet is the non-digestible parts that an owl can't use. So it's often fur, feathers, and bones. And depending on if it's a great horned owl, it may be several inches in size. And they're they're covered in mucus when they come up, so don't necessarily touch them, but look at them. They're pretty cool. You can tell what they had for dinner or breakfast, as it were. And then the boreal and the saw-whet, their pellets are going to be much smaller, mm-hmm. like maybe a grape smaller. But oftentimes owls have favorite places where they eat, mm-hmm. so you may find a couple pellets okay. underneath a tree, and you can try and look up. Maybe they're taking a nap during the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the mammal side of it, you end up with, regardless of who you are and what you're doing, you're leaving some sort of sign, whether it's tracks, hair, or scat. And those are some of the best indicators to start trying to figure out, hey, who went through this trail? Or, you know, hey, this wasn't here this morning. Who came through? And those are our big indicators, because there's a lot of track guides out there that people can use and pick up. I mean, there's probably an app out there that you take a picture of a track and it tells you what species, the size, and if it's male or female. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of signs that these animals give us to show that, yeah, we were here at one point, you just happened to miss us.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the most reliable signs that we can look for? Is it scat? Is that the one that, like, we as humans can see the easiest?
I would probably start with scat and then tracks and hair, especially, mm-hmm. you know, some of the animals, like an ermine, doesn't leave hair. Mm-hmm. And if they do, it's super small. But, you know, you can catch a moose walking through the spruce trees because you can see all that hair. Mm-hmm. Brown bears rubbing on a tree. You don't get that as much with your smaller mammals, but you always have tracks. Mm-hmm. You always have some sort of scat. It's just whether or not we're able to find it, right? Some of that is super small, and just being able to identify that that's scat and not just woody debris that happens to be on the trail.
So this is going to be a weird question, but I've always wondered it. So there's certain times of year where bear poop and moose poop, like, I can't tell the difference, or maybe I don't know which is which, but one sometimes of year they kind of look the same. Can you just, like, explain what we're looking for at different times of the year?
Yeah, so what everyone tends to see and associate with moose poop are the nice
mm-hmm. Nuggets.
Exactly. Yeah, they look like an owl pellet, just smaller.
Yeah.
And no bone in them. And that's what we think of as that moose scat, right? Except that the reason that it is like that is because they're just eating real poor quality food. It's really hard to digest. There's not a lot there. So the winter moose poop, right, is based off of their diet and the woody debris that they're eating. When they switch into the spring, that's where you start seeing, quote unquote, the cow pies. Mm-hmm. And it starts looking more like bear scat, right? And so for a while there, they look kind of the same. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing here is bears quickly get onto berries, seeds, any sort of carrion, meat that they can get and find. And so that changes the consistency. So you start seeing bones mm-hmm. and hair and stuff like that. You're not going to see bones and hair and moose. If you do, please let me know, because that is a...
There's something going on.
Absolutely something is going on. And that's where you start to see. So really it's looking at the scat mm-hmm. and being like, oh, look at all those seeds. Moose don't really eat blueberries, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Bears love them. So you see all, they're just full of seeds. And they may actually even be blue in color, that they eat so much mm-hmm. blueberries that it changes their scat color.
So it's only during that, like, really small one time of year that you could kind of, like, maybe get them mixed up just a little bit.
Yeah.
Then I wasn't completely wrong, because I feel like, oh, there's got to be some obvious sign that one is bear and one is moose, but...
That is the age-old debate. We always get scat questions like, is this bear, is this moose? So yeah. Lisa and I, when we go out, right, we're going a little bit slower. We're looking at, stopping and looking at trees. We're looking at the bank for an otter latrine, right? Those small signs that people just walk right by, or you smell that pungent fox smell and you think it's one of those silly mushrooms that people pick. Hmm. And then you realize, hey, that, you know, a fox has been through here mm-hmm. rather than, oh, it's just some disgusting rotting thing there on the forest floor. So it's really getting people to slow down and enjoy what's in front of them and see those details and be able to pick that out and learn more about what they have in front of them right there.
What does an otter latrine look like? You said it, so I have to ask.
So an otter latrine, so river otters defecate on land, and it's a form of communication as well as territory marking. Mm-hmm. So other river otters will come up they'll check it out, smell it. There's a lot of pheromones, a lot of smells that communicates things to other individuals. And really, it's just a pile of otter poop right there off the side, and it has a real distinct smell. Once you smell it, you'll never forget it.
What can you compare the smell to? Just in case anyone's walking by one.
That's a good question. I can't think of anything in the natural, like...
Wow.
Yeah, it's got its own...
That's unique.
Unique smell to it, yeah.
That was a clip from Kim's Concealed Creatures program she did earlier this year. Kim, what made you want to do the show, and what are some really neat things you learned while doing it?
You know, I'm obviously fascinated with animals, and you can probably tell that by a lot of the shows that I do.
I did notice.
Yeah. And so, you know, I just thought this would be a really cool show for, you know, just your everyday person in Anchorage to maybe take a moment and slow down and kind of notice what's around them. You know, take those earbuds out, take a listen, observe things. You know, there's a lot going on that we just don't pay attention to. And one of the super cool things about some of these shows is that I am getting a really big vocabulary and things I never even knew about, like an otter latrine. Who knew what that was?
And what it smells like, apparently.
Exactly.
Very unique.
Very unique. And the two guests that we had on were Corey Stantorf there and Lisa Padgett, and they were just a wealth of knowledge about all these things, and I really want to thank them for teaching us those lessons.
So we're going to jump into another clip from earlier this year. This one's from an interview I did with a guy. His name's Mike LaJoy, who is one of the co-founders of Arctic Comic Con. It's modeled after, of course, the San Diego Comic Con, which is one of the largest conventions in the world, celebrating all things pop culture, like video games, movies, and of course, you know, as the name implies, comic books. But Mike said he was worried sick that people were not going to show up to his very first Arctic Comic Con.
I had no budget. I was underfunded. It was just a dream. This is a passion project for me. I've been a collector of comic books and a fan of the art medium in general since I was about 6 years old. So,
do you remember the first comic that got you super into comics?
I do. It was X-Men. I want to say it's in the 160s. It was written by Chris Claremont, who's a prolific X-Men writer, years and years. John Byrne did the art, and they had such a thing going. I was immersed. I got into that book, and I realized this is what I want to do. I want to start collecting comics. So that's what I did. That's the book that hooked me.
Well, so how do you gauge the temperature for something like that? Like, can Alaska withstand that kind of convention?
I'm not going to lie. The first time, the first year we agreed to do it, I said, Brad, we can do this con. I want you to go to one with me. Brad's a concerts and events guy, but he'd never been to an actual Comic-Con. We started to see this on the Sci-Fi Network when they broadcast live from San Diego, things like that. And it generated a lot of interest, and Brad became interested in it. I said, well, yeah, we can do it. You got to go to one with me. So we hopped on a jet, and we went to Portland and went to Rose City Comic Con. And it took Brad all of maybe a half hour to go, wow, I get it. And it's there's such great family fun events. There's so much positivity. It's inclusive. Comic Cons are just so much fun. And so then we decided to do it. And, you know, I borrowed some money from my retirement. And Brad did the same to, you know, take care of deposits and things like that on the Denina Center and travel deposits and artist deposits. And we put it together. And the first year was terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
And that was 2018?
That was 2018. Okay, yeah. And, you know, Alaska tends to be a bit of a last second crowd for a lot of things, especially new things. So sure. Going into about 2 or 3 weeks before the event, I'm like, wow. I've made a terrible mistake.
Anyone going to come?
But people showed up and showed out, and the event has grown every single year since then.
Yeah, and it seemed like you had a really good 2019 as well, just based on the lineup and everything. But then 2020 happened, COVID. So what did that do to your trajectory you were starting to build there?
Well, yeah, it was a bit of a momentum killer. We had a lineup set for 2020, and at the last minute, of course, like the rest of the world, we had to go full pause. Mm-hmm. And we rebooked the con 4 times trying to get through COVID. So it was supposed to happen in April of 2020. We moved it to October. We're like, well, we'll take an October date. We'll see if we can do it then. October came, of course.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. So there were 4 times we rebooked the convention trying to make it happen during COVID. So a lot of the talent that was originally booked in 2020 hung on and still showed up in 2022.
Oh, that's great. Well, thankfully, conventions are back and in full force, fully attended. Well, it seems like one of the main draws of these conventions is creating a place to not only celebrate this culture we're talking about, right, by bringing these big names up, but just offering a spot that's inclusive where people can gather and really wear their passions on their sleeve, right?
That's my favorite part of the event, I'll be honest. The fact that everybody is welcome, the fact that everybody can come and just express themselves as who they are, you know, as long as it stays family friendly, we're 100% behind your expression. Right. You know, I've seen so many amazing things at cons, fundraisers, and just the passion of the fans themselves and how excited they are to be a part of this event is one of the things that makes me most proud to have brought this to Alaska. I can tell you in 2019, when we had Dean Cain, Dean left the convention in the middle of the day from signing autographs to go outside to autograph the bus of one of the congoers who was, you know, in a wheelchair. And he went out to the bus and autographed his bus in the middle of the day. And I saw a Facebook post from his sister that said he was having one of the best days of his life. And I ugly happy cry, 100%. But it really was one of the most gratifying things I've ever seen. And I'm so glad that we could make that connection.
Yeah. What has the response been from the people you bring up when they come to Alaska? I know there's so many misconceptions about Alaska and the people that live here. What do people tend to tell you?
I mean, we Brad and I focus really hard on making everybody feel like their family when they get here. And I've been to lots of other cons and I've seen how they operate. And we really try to personalize the experience for them too, so that when they come, they feel like they're part of our Alaskan family. And the response has been overwhelming. I mean, we get requests to come back from the artists, from the writers, from the actors, from the actresses, everybody involved. They really do love coming to Alaska. And Alaska gives us the ability, because it's on so many people's bucket list if they haven't been here, to bring some talent up that we would not normally be able to get. And I think Patrick Warburton is a pretty good example of that. Sam Jones had never been to Alaska before. And we got those guys because we're in Alaska. If we were in Des Moines, probably wouldn't be happening. But they're happy to be here for sure.
Take that, Des Moines.
I drove through there once. I won't go back.
Well, you mentioned the cosplay, and I know that's a big part of these comic conventions. What are some of the craziest or coolest outfits that you've seen where people are dressing up as their favorite characters from video games or comic books?
Yeah, I get to host the Cosplay Cup. We call it the Cosplay Cup. And every year we award first, second, and third place the best blacksmithing or armor creating and sewing. And the local cosplayers really do an amazing job of putting their cosplays together. Video games, animes, some of them are, you know, just from TV series or movies, and then of course comics as well. So the community really does come out and they do an amazing job of promoting their fandom.
Yeah, and how much time do you think goes into a costume like that? I mean, making armor is no joke.
Some of those costumes, they work all year. They know at the end of the con what they're going to dress as the next year. And they start working on them immediately. A lot of those costumes that they put together, they've worked 6 months on, or maybe a year, maybe even more. The cosplayers, the serious professional level cosplayers, put in an inordinate amount of work into their craft. And it's really, really impressive.
That was a clip from our Arctic Comic-Con show from earlier this year. Kim, are you a cosplayer by chance, or a little bit of a geek?
You know, I'm not a cosplayer. I've never done it, but I have always been curious about it. And I think that I would love to go to one of these conventions one year. I'm a people watcher, you know?
Totally.
And so I think this would be just like the best place for people watching that you could go.
Absolutely. Well, let's go ahead and get into our next clip. This one's one of yours, Kim. You found yourself inside of a whiskey warehouse earlier this year. And, you know, I was a little jealous that I was not invited. I'm listening to you and Ammon taste these fabulous whiskeys. What was it like? And how was that show for you?
You know, it was really fun. So our guests for this show were John Blasco, the CEO of Anchorage Distillery, and Devin Wagner, his head distiller. Being in the warehouse, seeing all of those barrels, again, I am learning new vocabulary. Pulling the bung. That is when you pull the cork out of the barrel. I hadn't heard that term before. And there is an actual thing as a bung hole. And that's the hole that the cork has made.
Right.
So once again, growing vocabulary. And, you know, it was really fun tasting the whiskey. I am not a whiskey drinker. And so as you listen to the clip, it's apparent, you know, when I taste it, that it kind of burns a little. I'm not used to that.
Yeah, I think the quote is smooth.
Exactly. I'm faking it, you guys.
So
I don't know.
Smooth.
Yeah, but this one was a lot of fun. It's going to be really fun to listen to.
Yeah, and I just want to say congratulations for not laughing like an absolute child every time you said the word bunghole, because I would have.
I mean, it took everything
every
I had.
Well, let's go ahead and take a listen.
So we've just entered the barrel warehouse, and we are going to taste test some young whiskey. So there seems to be three barrels high to each rack. And I don't know, how many barrels do you have in your 100 and something?
About 100 in here right now, of various sizes. Traditional whiskey barrels are 53 gallons or 200 liters. We also have some 30-gallon barrels here as well. The theory back in the day was that the smaller the barrel, the quicker the whiskey would mature, but that's not the case. It just takes time.
So is every barrel in here filled with whiskey, or is there anything else? And what is the age of the whiskey that we're going to taste?
Every barrel in this warehouse is filled with whiskey. It's either Palmer rye whiskey or Palmer wheat whiskey. There's some blends of Palmer rye and wheat in some of these barrels, just depending on how much volume I have left. And the barrel we're going to taste has been resting since August of last year.
What is it called? Tapping of the barrel?
Pulling a bung?
Pulling a bung? So what I just witnessed was the pulling of the bung, and it just seems like there's a little kind of cork in the barrel, and it seems like you might have to kind of aggressively get it out, maybe sometimes more aggressively than others, but after a while it popped right out, and I think we get to taste the innards of the barrel now.
This is one of the few professions where it's okay to say bunghole a lot. Yeah, so now I've got what's either considered a barrel thief, whiskey thief, wine thief. This specific design is called a Prouvette. The French use it a lot in cognac production. But yeah, I'll drop this through the bunghole and pull a sample. Move it around a little bit to mix it. The spirits will stratify and you'll get a bad sample.
So we just pulled the whiskey out of the barrel, and it actually kind of, to me, looks like a giant gun shell casing, copper. And so now we get to taste this amber-colored whiskey that just came out.
A lot of the color for whiskey is usually imparted into the spirit within the first few months of aging. It'll pick up some more throughout the aging process, but you can see this is a really nice amber golden hue. It smells like wheat whiskey to me. It smells young. You can kind of tell it's young because it still smells like when the distillate first came off of the still. It hasn't had time to really mature and pull all of those vanillins and other compounds out of the oak yet. Time to give it a try, I guess.
So my first sniff of the aroma smells like whiskey. I am not a huge whiskey connoisseur, so I can't tell the difference between the different probably aromas of vanilla and cinnamon and all the other things that people can pick out, but it smells spicy to me. Okay, we're going in. It tastes spicy, but it goes down smooth.
Is this one for me?
Yeah. This is from someone who doesn't drink a lot of just plain whiskey.
This is the producer taste. There is like there's a light bodiness to it. Yeah, I don't know. It's still got that whiskey burn, but it does feel like, if you hadn't told me that it was a young whiskey, maybe I wouldn't have noticed it. But knowing that it's a young whiskey, you can kind of be like, oh yeah, it's a little immature, I guess, but delicious.
Yeah, you can tell it's young. It's still got, it's very angular on the palate. It's very sharp in some areas. It's also high proof. I believe this went into the barrel around 120 proof. So it's probably there or even a little north of 120.
All right. So John is going to make us a cocktail. There goes the ice. And so what do we have here, John?
Took our raspberry vodka, and it's infused with dragon fruit.
Such a pretty color. And I even see some dragon fruit pulp in there.
And then next we'll be adding a tangerine syrup. And then lastly, we're going to do some fresh squeezed lime. We'll give this a nice shake, and we'll top it off with some club soda. And that there's your pitaya part.
All right, and I'm ready for my official taste test, and I think I'll be able to handle this a little better than the straight whiskey. I get a lot of raspberry, and the dragon fruit is really good, the tangerine. The alcohol is actually not very prominent, which is actually really nice. I could see drinking too many of these really easily. Yeah, it's beautiful. This really pretty pink color. Great job, John. Tom Cruise better watch out.
So, Kim, when you're taste testing and sampling whiskey, what is the etiquette here? Do you spit it into a bucket when you're done, or is that bad manners? I feel like Alaskans don't typically waste things, so
yeah,
I just drink it.
I mean, right? I wouldn't waste. There was no bucket available, which is probably means, you know, you just drink it. I guess it's not like wine where you could end up drinking a lot of it if you're not spitting it out. But, yep, no bucket available, so we swallowed it down, and that's probably why my voice sounded like it was cracking.
Yeah. So did you have a favorite whiskey that was palatable that you would be like, I would drink this without? And, you know, I mixed it in a cocktail at the end there, but.
Yeah, so straight, probably not up my alley.
Yeah.
But the cocktail at the end, I'm telling you right now, that was tasty. I could drink a few of those.
Yeah, it made me thirsty just listening to it. Well, it's time for us to take a short break. And when we return, Kim and I will be sharing some more snippets from our best of 2025 list. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron, and I'm here with my co-host, Kim Sherry, and we're looking back on some of our favorite shows from 2025. This next clip is from an interview I did with Matthew Bertner, who is an eco-acoustician, and that is someone who makes music based in nature. Very interesting and strange name, but they either record nature sounds and compose music around those sounds, or they take scientific data based in nature and then actually turn that data into music. And Matthew made an album recently that is completely focused with the theme of atmosphere.
There's kind of like very direct pieces like Peace for Northern Sky or Profiled from Atmospheres or Windrose. And then there's really kind of upper atmosphere like auroras, and then there's music like Nocturne, which is a moth music. So thinking of like vibration in the atmosphere and different ways of knowing our atmosphere. The moths don't hear in the same range as us. They listen to ultrasonic sounds, and so it's like we can't really have a direct conversation with a moth, but in this piece we do. And then Arbor, which is really more, it's focused on trees, forests and trees, but you know, it kind of imagines the forest as a, you know, respiratory part of the atmosphere and the ecology of it.
You talked about turning data into music, right? How do you do that? How do you feature an element of nature in music that does not make noise? Like, how would you do that with the sun?
Well, auroras is a piece that does that, right? The sun is creating these solar winds that project off the sun as electromagnetic energy. And luckily, our Earth has a magnetosphere that protects us from most of that. Some planets don't. It dips in at the poles, the positive and negative. So we get these, you know, these manifestations of the northern lights. Luckily, we don't hear the sun, because if we did, we would live on a planet that was like destroying our ears all the time. It's so loud. There's so much energy coming off
yeah,
the sun.
Yeah, true, yeah.
But there's no elastic medium between the sun and the Earth. So there's no way for the sound wave to propagate to reach us, which is good for us because we can hear other things.
Yeah.
But anyway, the auroras piece, actually it's kind of a mix between field recording and sonification. We call it audification in the field because it takes a parameter that you can't hear, like this electromagnetism, and it just directly converts it into sound. And the amazing thing about the Northern Lights is that they actually, like, the wavelengths are low frequency. They happen in the range of human hearing, but they're, you know, electromagnetism. So all you have to do with the circuit is run the real-time waveform across an audio circuit and listen to it. So that's a kind of audification. It's like data from the sun, but something that you can listen to.
So you're literally just tweaking the frequency of this data to make it audible.
Changing the frequency.
Oh, you're not even changing the frequency.
No, just putting it in headphones.
Okay.
And like
even better.
You know, you just, the only trick with that is that this device, this recorder that picks up the electromagnetic energy also picks up other electromagnetic energy. So, you know, it'll hear lights and, you know, buildings, electrical signals. It'll hear power lines. So if you really want to listen to the Northern Lights, you have to be at least 3 miles away from any electrical source. So that's kind of fun, right? You challenge, you get to go on a hike.
And what was it like to hear those sounds for the first time when you did put it through the right processors and everything?
It was really amazing, actually, because first of all, they don't sound like they look. Mm. You know, we just kind of think of the Northern Lights as, I don't know, they're just so smooth and spectacularly beautiful and colorful and
swooshy.
Yeah, swooshy. Like it's like really like a fast lava lamp or something, and you know, mellow. And yeah. But actually, they're not. They don't sound like that at all. They sound much noisier and crackly and pulsing and popping. And after listening to them for a while, now I don't look at the Northern Lights in the same way. I see the patterns that I can hear that I didn't notice before I was listening to them. But now when I see it, it's like, oh, there's that like weird strobing that it's doing, you know, that I saw before as a swoosh, but actually it looks like a strobe.
So let's go ahead and listen to that track, Aurora Now. So, Matthew, that sound that starts off, not what I expected Aurora to sound like as well. It's got like a radio static feeling to it, and then it blends into this orchestral, deep pulsing movement there. What happened in that transition there?
So we start off listening to just the Northern Lights, right? So just the VLF recorder, what it picks up directly from the atmosphere. And then I start combining those, like layering those sounds. There's like a lot of different kinds of sounds, those kind of high sweeping frequencies and these kind of crackling static. And then there's all sorts of interesting energy in that sound. And I wanted to make that a little more legible as music. So as the piece goes on, it starts kind of abstracting the energy from the Northern Lights. That is, removing the noise but keeping the amplitude profile and the signal energy, and then using that data to then play synthesizers. That's where that low sound comes from, that low drone sound.
That was a clip from my interview with Matthew Burtner, who made an entire album based on the atmosphere. And now we all know what auroras actually sound like, which, like Matthew said, doesn't necessarily match what they look like. Kim, this has been a good year for auroras. Have you gotten to see any?
Yeah, actually, you know, I am one who goes to bed fairly early, so typically I wouldn't get to see the auroras because I'm just not willing to stay up for that. But we've had some nights here where they are out. I'm talking like right after the sun goes down. I mean,
right.
It was like after 6 one night where we went to the end of our driveway and saw them, and it was really cool. So this year I have been able to see them, yeah.
That's great. I went on an aurora drive with my family when they were blowing up, apparently, and we just kind of missed them. I was really like bummed out. I've seen some really great ones in recent years, but I've kind of just missed them all this year. Okay, Kim, our next clip is from a show that you did about beekeeping in the winter. Did you get to wear the full, bee suit with the mask and the gloves?
So this time I did not. Our guest, Dusty Finley, did invite us out to his property when he was doing his bee honey collection. And that would have been a great opportunity to do it, but the schedules didn't line up. And so disappointingly, we did not get to do that. Yeah.
But did you get to taste some honey?
Absolutely. Yeah. He brought some honey in for us to taste. It tasted like honey. You know, it was great. It was sweet and, you know, just clean. And, you know, honey is a pretty amazing thing. So, yeah, it was really sweet of him to bring us some.
Yes, I agree. Well, let's go ahead and take a listen.
Our summers are short and prolific in terms of what the bees can do in terms of their ability to gather the nectar, process the honey, and store it for the coming winter. Unfortunately, people like me go in and steal the honey midsummer, which creates problems and forces me to feed them sugar water in order to substitute so they can survive the coming winter.
What are the biggest challenges of overwintering bees here? And can you just tell us a little bit about the process of how you start doing it?
There are several challenges with overwintering bees. The first is the food supply for the bees. And typically, it's a concentrated sugar water mixture that they will put back into the comb from which I've stolen the honey. The second has to do with ventilation. Because the bees give off a vapor inside the hive that condenses, if you don't provide a means for that vapor to escape the hive, regardless of how cold it is outside, it will potentially freeze and kill off the colony inside the hive. Third major challenge is the insulation for the hive. Anything you can do to help keep the hive warm, in my case, I use 2-inch foam insulation around the hives during the winter, significantly contributes to being able to allow the bees to keep themselves alive throughout the winter. And obviously, the fourth major factor is the overall length of the winter. And in my case, what I do is I'll take reptile heating pads and put it underneath the hive in the wintertime just to allow a trace element of heat to rise up through the hive that helps take the edge off and help keep the temperature inside the hive at a constant level for the bees to survive.
So this probably sounds like a dumb question, but they're not hibernating. So what are they doing in the hive all winter when they can't go out and play?
Bees do not hibernate, and they must be able to leave the hive during the winter because they will not urinate or defecate inside the hive. They must leave the hive to relieve themselves. So it's not a matter of just closing the hive up and mm-hmm. saying, have a nice winter. No, you have to provide them the means to go out, and typically they'll do that on sunny days, even when there's snow out. Mm-hmm. During the winter, the population in the beehive draws down. While they might be at a 40 or 50,000 bee population in the middle of June or July, that will drop down to potentially around 10,000-ish in the wintertime. The primary function of those 10,000 bees is to surround the queen in a ball, if you will, and keep her warm. And the bees continually move from the center of the ball to the outside of the ball, almost like looking at heat on the sun. As the cold bees on the outside come in the center, so they continually trade places. But the ideal is they generate about 60 watts worth of heat, same as an incandescent light bulb. Mm-hmm. And at about 90 degrees is what they have to keep the queen during the winter time frame.
Wow.
And if you didn't touch a hive at all in the summer, they would consume anywhere from 8 to 10 gallons of honey during the winter in order to stay alive.
Oh, I see. So are you continuously feeding them the sugar water during the winter then?
Once we extract the honey in the fall time frame, we will feed the bees sugar water. And there's different ways to do that. But they will take the sugar water and put it into the comb that we otherwise had taken the honey from. Mm-hmm. And it is that they will draw from throughout the winter. Mm-hmm. Once late October, November timeframe comes along, I don't open the hives again because every time you open the hive, whatever heat has been generated in there is lost.
Okay.
And it introduces a lot of trauma and stress on the bees to open the hive during the winter. So once I seal it up in November, basically they're on their own till about the late February, early March timeframe.
So I have to go back to the not defecating in the hive question. So after winter is over, is there like a little pile right outside the hive that they've got? Is it like, is there a noticeable pile?
Believe it or not, one of the challenges you have in the winter is when there's snow on the ground out in front of the hive, the bees will leave the hive and they get confused as to where the what direction up is, because the ultraviolet radiation is bouncing off the snow. They think the snow is up and they'll turn upside down and crash into the snow. So you have to keep the front of the beehive area cleaned out, you know, raked out. And like I'll throw some charcoal out there or some, you know, from the wood burning stove just to help create contrast. Mm-hmm. But they'll go out 10, 15, 20 feet, do their business. But you don't know. There's not a noticeable collection of anything.
Right.
You know, what will happen is if a bee dies inside the hive, they will summarily drag that bee out of the hive and kick it off the platform, and you will notice the bees on the ground. But in the summertime, you have the Steller's Jay and the various magpies that come around every morning and clean up the dead bees. So they kind of...
The nature, circle of life.
The circle of life. Yeah.
That was a clip from Kim's bee show she did earlier this year. Kim, what was his reason for keeping the bees all winter long? Most people, you know, euthanize their colony. So why did he keep them?
Yeah, so euthanization is typically what people will do because our winters are so hard to keep the bees. So like Dusty was saying, he has to put some sugar water into the beehives before he closes them up for the winter. And that's pretty much what they will sustain themselves on throughout the winter. And, you know, it's really up to them to keep themselves warm in that like ball of energy. And the harder our winters are, the harder it is for them to stay alive. So, you know, I think it's just something where the beekeepers don't necessarily want to have to euthanize the bees. So they do their best to try and keep them alive. But it's just really difficult in our climate. But I think Dusty gets a sense of accomplishment, you know, even if he only keeps two or three of his hives alive. I mean, and plus that's less bees to order in the spring. And, you know, it's an expensive hobby. So, you know, the more you can keep alive, you're keeping your costs down a little bit.
I would definitely keep them alive if I had bees, just because my kids won't even let me kill a spider or a fly. So.
Absolutely.
I'm keeping those bees
you do your best
long.
To keep them alive.
Our last clip we're going to play from this year was definitely from one of my favorite interviews I ever got to do. I had the honor of interviewing astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who came up to Anchorage over the summer and he did a couple of talks. One of them was an astrophysicist goes to the movies talk, where he talked about whether or not these movies had any science based in them, like Armageddon and like all these like science, quote, science movies. And that was really fun. And then another one about the cosmos. But when I got to interview him, I found out that he was no stranger to Alaska. Is this going to be your first time coming to Alaska?
Oh, no. I've been to Alaska a bunch of times. My wife is from Alaska.
No way.
Way?
Where
in
Alaska?
She was raised in Fairbanks.
In Fairbanks. Oh, man.
Her sister's still up there. We have friends. So maybe I've been up a half dozen times, not 100 times, but enough to know and feel the place. Sure.
Yeah.
And we went in the winter once. Okay, that's the thing I'm only going to do once.
Yeah. So did you see the Northern Lights when you were up here?
No, we didn't. I was disappointed.
Yeah, I bet.
Went during solar minimum, so I've got to schedule the sun a little better for my trips.
Well, I completely have to change my line of questioning. How did you meet your wife?
In graduate school at the University of Texas. So we met in a neutral state. I from New York City, she from Alaska. We met in relativity class. She has a PhD in mathematical physics, and I thought that was cute.
Yeah, they say opposites attract, but not always, huh? Sometimes there's plenty.
Yeah, I mean, I think whatever attracts is what attracts, right? If you make rules about it, you can miss things.
From an astrophysical standpoint, what are some things that set a northern location like ours apart from other places? I think Alaska's already pretty known for some things like the Northern Lights, but what are some less known facts or benefits to living in a northern climate from your standpoint?
So it's fun going that far north. We were there over the summer solstice, and in Fairbanks there was a midnight softball game I participated in a few years back. That was fun. And I think Fairbanks is, 6 degrees from the Arctic Circle, something like that. So the sun didn't get very far below the horizon, of course. So it's twilight the whole night. And so, of course, it's colder. The sunlight doesn't heat as directly as it does as you go to more equatorial climes. What is interesting, however, in the world of climate change, where they report that the Earth is 1 degree, 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer, and you say, well, that's not much. I mean, my temperature range in a day is is 10 times that. Why should I worry about if the whole Earth is that?
Yeah, right.
But what that misses is the fact that the greatest temperature shifts that only will average to the 1.5 degrees happens near the poles. And so there's less temperature shift at the equator than at the poles. So that worldwide it averages to about 1 to 1.5 degrees in recent measurements. But it's much warmer in the poles. So I haven't asked people, but I'm guessing you're experiencing milder winters than when my wife grew up, where this still freaks me out. She says, only when it was colder than 20 below zero Fahrenheit in elementary school was it optional to go outside and play during recess.
Yes, that sounds like a Fairbanks thing for sure. And a lot of
I said, damn, you're all some hardy people. You all some thick-blooded heart.
We are, yeah. We're a different breed for sure. And you're absolutely right. We just had a show on this last month. We're having an unusually warm winter. We had no snow in the middle of January, which is almost unheard of. I mean, just bare, dry streets. It's really quite unsettling if you've lived here.
Yeah, yeah. And so the way I talk about that is, don't think so much of global warming. You can, but that will miss some other elements here. You should think of climate change. Mm-hmm. And if humans are changing the climate, then what's happening is cities that were formed over the relatively stable period of Earth's climate since the last ice age, right? We warmed up out of the ice age. Earth's climate has been relatively stable. And what I mean by that is, there's some cold winters and hot summers. And you say, okay, let's figure out how we survive this. Well, we'll bring in air conditioning. That'll help out the summers, maybe. Mm-hmm. In the winters, I need extra coats. Okay, I need a better fireplace or stack robber, whatever you put in to keep your place warm. All right. So you've created a world in which you live that experiences a range in climate that persists over the centuries.
Yeah.
In other words, you could have like there'd be a flood. Oh, we got that flood every 20 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a heat wave. Oh, we had a heat wave like that 50 years ago. Oh, we have a cold snap. It's cold. Last we had that was the 1920s. You've experienced that. It is in the life experience of the city. Okay. When you change the climate, the climate starts reaching outside of the zone that you grew accustomed to. So if you ever had a drought before, you'll have more of a drought. Or if you ever had rainy season before, it can be more rainy than you have ever experienced. This is what happened in Los Angeles, where they haven't had rain since October. It was the longest drought ever in their recorded history. Mm-hmm. That's outside of the life experience of the town. So they don't have ways of coping with extra dry plant life and the risk of fire. Another interesting fact about Los Angeles is you may have seen, made famous surely in more than one movie, but certainly in Terminator 2, Arnold Schwarzenegger rides his motorcycle down into this river basin, but it's called the LA River, but it's all cement on the sides,
right,
and concrete on the sides. And there's a tiny little strivel of water going down the middle. What is that? Mm. Well, LA realized occasionally they have heavy rainstorms and they need a way to guide the water so it doesn't flood the city. So they built that. That's part of the defenses a city puts up to live within the climate range that had existed for centuries and even millennia. You start changing climate on a timescale of decades. Oh my gosh. The droughts can be more severe. The rains can be more severe. The heat waves can be more severe. The cold droughts can be more severe in the wrong time, in the wrong place. And it freaks everybody out. So I'm not surprised that you're in a position to describe conditions that basically, frankly, are the new normal for life on Earth.
That was a clip from earlier this year, much earlier this year, when we were actually having a super, super warm winter. Not the case right now. So you can thank Neil and myself for cursing us into this cold, cold winter we're having now. Definitely one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. I had goosebumps going into that record cam. Can you believe it? I hadn't felt like that in a long time.
I'm really jealous. It is a really cool interview to do.
I was like, I'm not worthy. I'm going to sound stupid. You know, and I was actually listening to some other interviews he did preparing for the interview. And he like kind of shoots back at the people asking questions a lot, like really, you know, not in a mean way, but just kind of like a fun, punchy way. And I was like worried he was going to do it to me. So
I would feel really nervous going into that. So really great job.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Well, Kim, we're going to be starting our winter break next week, but we will be back January 12th. And in the meantime, as I said at the top of the show, please do reach out to us at our email if you have comments or show ideas or anything really that comes to mind, hometown@alaskapublic.org. We don't say it at the end of the show just for fun every time. We really do want to hear from the community. I want to thank my co-host, Kim Sherry. Kim, thanks for coming in today and hanging out with me and looking back on this fun year that we've had.
Absolutely. Dave, thanks for having me. I mean, I just remember our very first interview together, and I don't think we've done anything together since, so this has been really fun.
We haven't, and we need to do it. We've talked about co-hosting a show before, and I think we'll do it before the end of 2026.
Yeah, so. I believe the last idea we had was searching Anchorage for the best taco, and I'm telling you right now, I'm totally into that idea.
Taco Quest. Yeah, yes. Taco Quest 2026. You know, because everyone, I feel like most people in our state kind of agree on what the best pizza is. I'm not going to name names of any establishments. But we sort of agree on like who the best pizzerias are, best beers too. But I feel like tacos is
tacos are up for grabs.
Really up in the air.
I think we need to do some research.
All right, Ammon, you heard it. We're doing a taco show.
It's up to us.
Okay. Well, after this short break, we'll be back with State of Art. I'm Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Time to eat.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, a theater production created and developed in Alaska has been invited to perform in New York City at the end of January. It's called Overland, with an exclamation point, and was previously titled Blanche Stewart Scott after the play's adventurous protagonist. The lighthearted story is loosely based on her real-life journey in 1910, where she became the first woman to drive across the continental United States. Before the crew heads to New York, they will be putting on a fundraising show in Anchorage on January 9th in the Performing Arts Center. We're joined by playwright Kristen Ritter and lead actor Katie Lawrence. I previously spoke with Ritter last summer ahead of the play going to Los Angeles for the SheLA Theater Festival, where the production won awards for Best Director, Lead Actor, and Best Ensemble. Lawrence says the experience was hectic but worthwhile.
So we have photos of us halfway in costume, hairs done up in a Gibson style, pulling rolling luggage full of props and costumes and
the entire frame of
the car. Frame of the car. Because this is a road trip, our main set piece is a replica of the 1910 Overland motor car. And so the frame of it, one of our cast members is carrying it down Melrose Avenue.
Do you think that's why you won Best Ensemble?
I think so. I think they saw how well we work together.
Yeah.
Let's just give it to them. They're very tired.
You have been invited to take the show to New York. And it sounds like there's a really kind of cool theater that you're working with there. Could you tell me about how that got set up and the theater that you're going to be performing in?
The Tank is a theater and an organization in New York that works to remove economic barriers for artists. So they provide the theater, they provide rehearsal space, they provide box office, like everything you would need to perform a show. And you just submit a script to them. We submitted Overland, and it was chosen. So we got invited to go out to New York, and we were like, do we want to travel this show again? And we all decided, yes. We launched a whole new campaign, and we're building a third car at this point, and we're just going to keep doing it.
Matching tattoos, Overland tattoos.
It's been discussed.
We're working on it.
Fellowship style. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you give me the dates of the New York performance? I'm sure there's got to be somebody listening that will be in New York during this time. So could you just kind of list? I know there's a few dates, just in case.
Yeah, so it'll be January 23rd, 24th, and 25th at the Tank Theater in New York City. And if you are going to be in New York, it's a great time. Get tickets. They're at thetanknyc.org.
But for all of you folks who cannot make it to New York City, there's going to be a fundraiser show in Anchorage ahead of that. So what's the plan for that?
That will take place on January 9th. And it's in the Sydney Lawrence Theater at the Alaska Performing Arts Center.
Let's give the rest of the crew a shout out. I mean, we talked about director Callie Denali Randall. She's been on this show a few times, helped us out with some radio audio drama that we did this last Halloween by consulting with us. Who else is on this cast that we want to give some props to?
Well, there's Danielle Rabinovich, who is incredible and plays opposite Katie in the lead role. There's Aaron Bell, who is our Wes and has also built many of the cars that we have used through various shows. There's Martha Robinson, who's just incredible. She's the nicest person. She plays this outlaw bandit, so it's very fun to see that side of her, and it's just a blast.
She's also taken on the role, especially with this New York production, of doing a lot of our task coordination. Mm. So when we have business meetings before every rehearsal, she's the one who is taking to get down all of the notes and tasks that need to be done and kind of keeping all of that moving forward, which is incredible. Yeah. Probably also give a shout out to Mark Miller, who is my dad.
Yes.
Who is building the car for New York this year. We originally were going to try to have it built in New York City, but the costs were incredibly high, and he stepped in and is building us not only a car, but it's actually a car that can break down into modular pieces because we have to ship it and get it into the theater in New York. And that's a narrow doorway. So we're really grateful for that, too.
That was my conversation with playwright Kristen Ritter and actor Katie Lawrence. They're part of the play Overland, which will be having performances in New York City at the end of January, but will be holding a fundraising show on January 9th at the Performing Arts Center. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
And that's all for our show. Thanks to my co-host, Kim Sherry. Ammon Swenson produces this show. You can find us at the Hometown Alaska page on alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Dave Waldron.
And I'm Kim Sherry.
And thank you for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.